She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And we are going to give you lots to think about today, lots of great information to share from our guest. And I just want to mention that our show today was made possible due to the generous support of Habitat for Humanity Tucson, whose goal is to create a more compassionate and just world by bringing people together to build homes, communities, and hope. And we thank them for the great work they do and for all of their support of Mrs. Green's World. The name of our show today is actually Green Peace on Earth. And I am very honored to have as our guest Ralph Scar. Ralph is the director of Greenpeace USA Forest Campaign, and I want to tell you a little bit about him. Since 2007, he has contributed to international Greenpeace campaigns to stop deforestation in the Canadian boreal forests, the paradise forests of Southeast Asia, and the Brazilian Amazon, which you all know is near and dear to my heart. He has appeared on NPR, Fox News, and Sea of Change Radio, and has been mentioned in Reuters, The Washington Post, LA Times, Tom Hartman, among others, and now Mrs. Green's World. So welcome, Ralph. We're glad to have you here.
I'm happy to be here.
There's lots to share, and I'm going to fire away the questions. It's always good to start with a little bit more about your background. You have a longstanding commitment to the environment, so why don't you just give us a little bit of background about you?
Yeah, well, thanks. I was one of those kids that I grew up in Connecticut, and there was woods behind my house, and I was often found back there. My mom would have to call me in for dinner, like a dog for a meal.
Because, my mom rang the bell. Yes.
Pretty much, yeah. And I wanted to be in the woods, and that was my world. And as I grew up, you know, that connection to forests and to the earth and to the, you know, people and planet. Relationships sort of stayed with me, and so I became an activist as soon as I could. In high school, I founded an Earth Club and tried to set up some recycling at my high school. And then when I went on to college, you know, that sort of continued to blossom. At my college, we didn't have environmental studies. I didn't know you could do it as a profession.
For a living.
Yeah, it didn't seem to make sense to me. I didn't know anyone who did it for a living, and so I was prepping to be somebody else professionally and to do this sort of on the side as my passion. And then, wouldn't you know it, you know, I graduated and had sort of an aha moment and sort of started to work my way into the environmental community. As I moved to Oregon, there were lots of opportunities to volunteer and get involved with grassroots efforts to save forests and to reduce our impact on the world. And so just by sort of volunteering and falling into things, here I am many years later, now a professional, and I'm glad that I took that path.
But, you know, you're actually quite young in the big picture, and what makes me happy in making that observation and the relevancy to me is that how wonderfully things have changed in terms of what colleges and universities offer. They have entire offices of sustainability. There's such a much bigger movement now to get degrees in many fields related to the environment and sustainability in not that long a time. You know, it's not like you're 65 years old. you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right. You know, if I was just maybe 2 or 3 years younger, my little liberal arts college in Minnesota, you know, would have had an environmental study.
Right,
you know,
right.
Concentration. So I missed it by just a hair. But now I agree, and it's not just environmental studies or environmental science or all kinds of, you know, formal fields. It's integrated into, you know, if you're getting an MBA now, you know, the idea of corporate social responsibility and sustainability is integrated into most of those programs. It's not isolated field anymore.
And it's really pretty wonderful to see the different integration of all of the things that we need to do for a healthier planet, because that on that end, things have not drastically improved, I would not say personally, since you were doing your work in starting Earth Clubs. my personal commentary. I'm a little scared once in a while when I read things like "This changes everything." You know, Naomi Klein's book. It's like, people, we better wake up faster, quicker. What about the overall mission and vision for Greenpeace, and what's it working on, working to do on behalf of all of Earth inhabitants? I'm a big admirer of and supporter of Greenpeace. So what's their overall mission?
Well, to sum it up quickly, it's in our name. It's for a green and peaceful future.
I love
hope that most people can join us in agreeing that that would be a good thing, a green and peaceful future. And so Greenpeace has been around for over 40 years and is the largest environmental campaigning organization in the world. In other words, you know, we sort of we're out there sort of pushing for the change we want to see very actively. And one thing that really allows us to do that and sets us a little bit apart, you know, we all have a role to play, and different NGOs, you know, have legitimate roles to play, but Greenpeace is to be a bit more of a pusher sometimes, is the fact that we don't take money from corporations or from governments.
It's
and
huge.
So we don't have any sort of
right.
built-in sort of disincentives to kind of call out bad actors and bad behavior when we see it.
Yeah, you can say what you want.
Yeah, and that's part of what's kept me at Greenpeace for going on 8 years now, is that that's not only just sort of an ideological thing. It helps me feel a little better when I go to sleep at night sometimes, but it's actually a powerful thing that the fact that we can't, we can't be bought off. That makes a big difference in the work that we do and the effectiveness of the work that we do.
I call it instant cred. I mean, it's like environmental working group. You can trust anything they say because they are totally member supported. I mean, they don't take any government money. And Greenpeace is another one, doing the good work without having to be afraid of what your lobbyist is going to say. Sorry. I mean, there's no more. That's putting it bluntly, right? Now you.
Yeah, and
go ahead.
That's right. And not getting involved in politics either. I mean, we have issues and we are mission driven, but we're not Republicans or Democrats or Green Party or independents. And we think that's important for the success of our work. Is you know, it needs to be something that's owned by everyone. It can't be accessible only to, you know, a certain political party or affiliation.
And there shouldn't be polarization when it comes to preservation of the planet. I mean, it's one of my biggest taglines. Let's all work together because we all breathe the same air. And we're all inhabitants of the same Earth. You know, I have a lot of questions for you, and I really loved doing the research for the show, but I kind of wanted to read to the audience. Occasionally I do that, read to our listeners. This is a note from you, and I love it. You're currently working on stopping deforestation, mostly in the tropics, with my Greenpeace colleagues around the world. And this is what I want you to talk a little bit about. We start with a place. Then, through careful research, we figure out what is driving deforestation. In many places, it's the cultivation of things like cattle, soybeans, and palm oil. And then the next step, and so this, you can go through what you gave to me. We trace the commodities to the end users. We all know that they are often big consumer good companies like Nestle, Procter & Gamble, Kimberly-Clark. And then through collaboration, and when necessary, hard-hitting, creative campaigning that harnesses people power to motivate companies to take action, because some companies are doing turnabouts. They are trying to change some practices and taking big steps. So talk a little bit about the process that you lead up. Was that the longest question you ever heard, like, since you've been ever been interviewed? But you get it.
I appreciate that. Yeah, a lot of people are confused about why Greenpeace, you know, is campaigning on a certain company or a certain cause. A lot of companies think that it's because we're out to get them, like we have it out for them for some reason. It's never personal. It's not about putting a company out of business or something like that. We don't have the power to do that. But what we do, we are mission driven, and we start with a strategic plan. So our goal in the International Forest Campaign is zero deforestation globally. Now that sounds like a crazy idea to a lot of people. What do you mean zero deforestation? Does that mean we can't cut a tree ever again? No, that's not what it means. What it means is that, you know, the most important natural forests, the ones that, you know, we don't need to produce things like 2x4s or toilet paper, because, you know, we've already cleared upwards of 90% of the big intact forests on the landscapes across the world, that we end deforestation before we run out of those natural forests. So at some point, you know, we're going to run out, let's do it in a sensible and deliberate way rather than an accidental way and then say, oops, and realize too late what we've lost. So we start with that as a goal, and then we look at where deforestation is the worst. And in many cases, that's the tropics. So places like Indonesia, which has had a record-breaking rate of deforestation in recent years.
No kidding.
The Amazon and then the Congo Basin, which is the second largest rainforest on the planet. A lot of people overlook it, but it's a very huge rainforest in Africa, where development and foreign investment is starting to drive deforestation there as well.
What is the driver there? Is it to grow cattle mostly? To raise cattle,
It's a variety of things, and things like palm oil, like other large agriculture. Mostly it's agriculture.
Okay.
And then some infrastructure projects, as they build roads into areas, especially areas that don't have very strong governance or regulations. Once you build a road, then people start showing up and clearing forest and doing whatever they want with it. It's a little bit like the Wild West used to be in the U.S.
Right.
It's a frontier that doesn't have a lot of oversight, and that can mean a lot of bad things for forests and for people.
And, we can't go away without talking about from the topic, because I'll tell you, I told you yesterday when we spoke briefly about I loved your interview on Fox about toilet paper, because that's as funny as it is to talk about and as many jokes can be made. When you start messing with people's toilet paper, it's up close and personal. And toilet paper and paper towels are a massive consumer of trees. Agreed? That's so much of what and paper towels like in restaurants, and so much of what trees are cut down for are for uses like that. Is that correct?
Yeah, the pulp and paper industry is a huge user of trees and has a huge impact on forests. And so while, publications like newspapers are getting less common, the growth in tissue business is skyrocketing, because parts of the world where, toilet paper and napkins and paper towels weren't that commonplace maybe 10 years ago is now starting to take off. And so I think we're going to see, increasingly large amounts of pulp and paper being used for throwaway tissue and paper products. And so, that was one of the main reasons that we launched a campaign years ago against Kimberly-Clark, the maker of Kleenex,
right,
and the largest tissue manufacturer in the world. And thankfully, after years of campaigning, Kimberly-Clark came around and we stopped campaigning and started collaborating. And more than 5 years on now, it's a real success story. So now when I see a Kleenex in my mom's house, I can know that it's the fiber in that Kleenex is not coming from endangered forests, and that it's respecting indigenous people's rights. I can feel pretty darn good about
guilt-free sneezing. I mean, seriously, it's like. And the other thing is, I learned a lot about toilet paper early on in the Mrs. Green's World journey. What makes the Charmin so soft are the long, much sought-after fibers. I mean, it's a very conscious manufacturing process, and it certainly gave me a new spin on being much more, conservative in the use of it. So, and tissue's the same thing. What about logging? Can you talk a little bit about logging and maybe simplify for us some of the issues surrounding, like, illegal logging and its far-reaching impact?
Yeah, a lot of people will be surprised to learn that enormous amounts of the deforestation and the logging that's associated with it around the world is actually illegal, or at least not regulated. It's sort of like the black market. And whether or not you're a certified card-holding tree hugger or not, there's a reason that you might want to care about illegal logging and maybe join us in helping to crack down on it. Because like any commodity that's sort of in the black market, illegal logging can be traced to a lot of really bad things. A lot of dictators, for example, in Africa have used illegal logging to fuel their military exploits, the repression of people. Once you have a commodity and you turn it into cash, you can buy guns, you can do other things. So just like blood diamonds, there is such a thing as blood wood out there, and it can be tied to really serious human rights abuses that we all should care about.
You're right. I'm telling you what, I did not know that. I mean, and I'm so familiar and have done shows about blood diamonds and dirty gold and all that, so blood would. So they're using human power, exploiting it, and it can be a filthy industry as well. Agreed?
That's right. I mean, it's used, it can have huge effects on afterwards, after it's sold and then, used to prop up regimes or fuel civil strife. But also the act of illegal logging itself means there's people on the other end who are losing their lands and their livelihoods, because forests aren't just trees. If you go to the Amazon, there's people living in the Amazon.
I know.
There's indigenous peoples who've been there since time immemorial. And so when illegal loggers show up and start to cut down the forests they depend on for their day-to-day life, they're taking away those people's livelihoods and their way of life, and sometimes their cultures. And so there's enormous concern over, forest-dependent peoples and the impact that illegal logging has on them.
And like in Borneo, they cut down one tree and build a home for it, for a family, a newlywed family or whatever, that lasts forever. And they take, one tree and use all of it, all at a time. But let's go back to places like the Congo, when you talk about what's going on there. Is there a way that Greenpeace can impact that kind of situation that's so dangerous and violent and, really scary? Are there ways that you have found that are effective, or do you put your efforts where you know that you can have more of an impact?
No, we absolutely, we have to go to these places and operate in places where, it's not always safe or easy to do. So we have staff in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Cameroon in particular. And we have had some successes. First of all, there's a lot of foreign investment pouring into places like Cameroon, including U.S. companies who are setting up shop to do things like make palm oil plantations. And we highlighted in recent years one firm out of New York that was throwing down money, was looking to cash in on this rush to make palm oil. They were planning on making a huge palm oil plantation right in the middle of chimpanzee and forest elephant habitat, in between several national parks in Cameroon. Cutting off the connectivity, the habitat connectivity between those parks, and inflaming local communities who didn't know about these projects, and one day showed up, checking on the crops in the forest that they've cultivated for generations, and suddenly found markers in the forest. Suddenly, this was not their land anymore, and they had never been told about it, and they objected to it. So it's that kind of thing that when we call it out and we're able to shine an international spotlight on it, it can help set new standards for what agribusiness should look like.
And kind of activate the matrix. I mean, there's good ways to do things that you can actually make money. And like palm oil, I'm going to do my first national show ever on palm oil. I call it the ubiquitous palm oil that's in everything from your food to your skincare lotion. It's the cheap, nasty filler that we shouldn't be having anything to do with. My bias again. So yeah, palm oil, bad, really bad stuff. So we have to, I'm famous for doing this. We have to take a break in about a minute and a half. In a minute and a half, can you talk about destructive but legal logging? Are there any countries that are doing it legally, but it's still destructive?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that's why when we're pushing for zero deforestation, it doesn't mean no logging, but it means certain areas should be off limits. And if you're going to do silviculture, logging, you should do it in a sustainable way. And so if we look at Brazil, there's a lot of logging that is in a gray area where it's unregulated and it's sort of off the map and people are gaming the system. Even if you abide by Brazil's laws, it doesn't mean you should be cutting deep into the Amazon rainforest, what's left of the Amazon rainforest.
No kidding.
And so we need to have another layer. Legality is one thing, but a lot of countries have rules that truly aren't sustainable, and so we need to go beyond legality to sustainability. And that's where I think marketplace pressure and demand from consumers can really help.
Which I want to talk about. We have about 30 seconds and we come back. I want to continue with that and then talk about I'd like you to give us a report card on the U.S. and how we're doing. It may sound corny, but I'm a forest lover, and shouldn't we all be lovers of the forest, even for selfish reasons? So we'll talk about that and continue on a little bit about marketing pressure. Everybody, stay here with me. Great discussion with Rolf Skaar. He's the director for Greenpeace USA Forest Campaign. We'll be right back.
In the mid-Tucson summer, you would expect it to be over 100 degrees. But deep beneath the University of Arizona's compost heap, temperatures can hit 160. Started by the Compost Cats student group, the U of A Compost Project is collecting tons of waste from around campus and keeping it out of landfills. Gathering garbage and converting it into a useful product for the community? Now that's a hot idea indeed. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Find everything you need for your next adventure at Bookman Sports Exchange. Buy it new, buy it used, or trade up and go where you've never been before. Explore this big backyard we call Tucson. Bookman Sports Exchange has the gear you need for anything from a quick day hike in Sabino to a long backpacking trip through the Grand Canyon. Bookman Sports Exchange, open daily, located on Speedway, east of Country Club. For details and more information, visit bookmansports.com.
Ready to clean out that garage? Goodwill offers you 40 convenient locations all over southern Arizona. And at every one, you'll be greeted by a uniformed Goodwill employee trained to assist you in unloading your items, prepared to offer you a receipt for your tax-deductible donation, and grateful for something you won't get anywhere else.
Thank you. Because of your donation, I have a job.
The gift of Goodwill. For a list of Goodwill donation sites, go to goodwillsouthernaz.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Today, we are asking you to think about Greenpeace on Earth, and it so literally means that. Joining me today is just an amazing, content-rich guest named Rolf Skaar. He is the director of the Greenpeace USA's Forest Campaign. And Rolf, we were talking about market-based campaigning. I think it'd be great to expand on that a little bit about how you affect change in places that you activate the matrix.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of people think that environmentalists are all about regulation and telling you what to do through some sort of big brother schemes, but that's actually not the case anymore. Greenpeace has evolved over the years, and in our forest campaign, the majority of the work that we do is just in the marketplace. And we know that consumers don't want things like tiger rainforest destruction when they buy a piece of paper. They know there's a better way of doing things, and they expect more from the companies that provide products for them. And so we know that we can win in the court of public opinion and in the marketplace as long as we have our facts right and we share it and we expose what's going on. We know that we can win. And money talks, no matter what the politics of a particular region or country is, when there's large amounts of money and powerful industries and companies involved, you can get things done. It sort of creates political space in many cases. When industries want to do the right thing, they often need government help and government reforms to do that. So we're starting to see that in places like Indonesia, where the government was very closed off to the idea of addressing deforestation not too long ago. Now that some large pulp and paper company and some large producers of palm oil and other industries are starting to realize that zero deforestation pledges are good for business, the government's starting to listen. So we think that the marketplace is where we want to start with much of our work.
And you make such a point about the voice of the people making good money sense. Like some of these companies that are massively consuming and destroying, they're going to be out of business. I mean, that's the way I look at it. I am definitely I'm a capitalist, and come on, guys, there's way to do this right and continue to make money. So it's, to me, I love that whole thing. And I wrote down, we can win in the court of public opinion. That'll be a hashtag for the show. I love that. How are we doing in the United States? What's our report card and how much is already destroyed? We've done a lot of like not so good things, but how are we doing now? Say over the past 100 years.
Yeah. You know, if you look at the history of sort of Europeans, once they arrived in the U.S., we sort of clear-cut our way across the country, and we lost most of the you know, old-growth or intact forest landscapes. It's not that there aren't any trees left anymore, but, you know, an old-growth forest, one that is functioning as a big ecosystem, there's not a lot of that left, especially in the lower 48. And so you'll see most of the controversial logging that's going on now in the U.S., is on our public lands, which have been sort of like our national forests.
Right.
Which, when a lot of people look on a map, they see sort of a green barrier, and a lot of people think they're like national parks, but they're not. They're actually heavily logged, and often at taxpayer expense. So it's this old-fashioned sort of subsidized logging project that sort of feeds part of the timber industry. Subsidized logs on the backs of taxpayers, and that hurts drinking watersheds and fish and wildlife and the recreation opportunities that are increasingly important for many local communities. And so Greenpeace has been critical of that program, thinking that instead of subsidized logging projects that are sort of boom and bust and don't really have long-term benefits, that we should be investing more in restoration on our national forests, because there are just thousands, hundreds of thousands of abandoned logging roads that are just decaying and eroding into our drinking watersheds here in the American West and across the country, that really should be fixed first before we start building more clear cuts.
Right, do the cleanup.
Yeah, you can pay people good wages to do that, and then when the job is done, instead of just stump fields, you actually have a healthier watershed and many other benefits that continue to give us economic boosts.
And that's huge, which is a perfect segue, because another quote that I read, I was like, I kept finding myself writing down these quotes because I couldn't do any better. On the website somewhere, it says, and this is my humor, whether it's convincing Barbie to go for greener packaging, I love that, or partnering with the music industry to promote responsible sourced instruments, our supporters can fortunately celebrate several victories for the forests. So let's talk about some of the recent campaign successes. I don't know who wrote that, but like, if you're bringing Barbie in with the music industries, you've got some creative genius work going on there. I just loved it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. You know, like I said, we usually start with a priority region. So in the case of Barbie, that was Indonesia. And we said, what's going on here? What's driving the deforestation? Rather than just trying to protect patches of forest and hoping that will be enough for people and for endangered wildlife, let's just take away the underlying drivers, the economic reasons for why these forests are being felled so quickly. And what we found out was that the pulp and paper industry, and in particular the biggest pulp and paper company in Indonesia called Asia Pulp and Paper, or APP, was leading the charge in the wrong way in terms of deforestation. And we traced Asia Pulp and Paper's pulp and paper upstream through supply chains. And what we found out was that companies like Mattel, the maker of Barbie, were wrapping their Barbie dolls quite literally in rainforest destruction. You know, wood that had come from tiger rainforests, rainforests important for endangered Sumatran orangutans, forests that were embroiled in very serious social conflicts as well. And when we wrote to Mattel about it, they didn't really have a response. My guess is they didn't know what to make of it, or they were hoping that Greenpeace might go away.
Right.
But this problem is still there, so we're not going away until the problem is addressed. And so then we launched a campaign against Mattel, having some fun with the Barbie brand,
because
it's that people recognize the world over. And I'm glad to say that Mattel came out with a paper buying policy, a global paper buying policy, which they didn't have before. They didn't have any real sustainability standards for the paper they were buying.
What a victory. I mean, you talk about a victory. That's great. And it's all when you're talking, it makes me think about one of the mantras for my show is that we suffer in this whole topic under the topic, environmental sustainability or whatever, from a lot of silos. You know, the water people don't talk to the wood people, who might not be talking to the solar people. So to me, Greenpeace has a lot of integration of thought from start to finish. And it's you know, high praise. So that's a successful campaign. Are there any others that you want to talk about? I mean, that's like, I feel like ringing the bell for that one.
Well, yeah, that was great. But again, the, you know, Mattel and Barbie are a way of creating some pressure down the supply chain back to those responsible for forest destruction. So if you're buying the forest destruction and you're wrapping your Barbies in it, you're responsible because, you know, it's your money that's fueling it, and you have to take responsibility. But it's not enough just for Barbie or other companies to have a policy. What we want to see is real change on the ground.
Right.
I was happy to report that not long after that campaign, we saw Asia Pulp and Paper, that big number one forest destroyer in Indonesia, actually do almost the unthinkable and come out with a zero deforestation pledge.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's been about 2 years on now since they announced that in February of 2013, and they've stuck to it. They stopped the bulldozers. They stopped their own clearance of rainforest. They have a lot of things to still address, including especially social issues. They have some serious conflicts over sort of who has rights to what land, and some of that is related to corruption and sort of chaos in terms of the Indonesian government's handing out permits, essentially, to manage certain lands. But at least they stopped the bulldozers for now, and that's a real victory that's meant real change on the ground.
Huge change. And what I don't think a lot of people are aware of, they are if they listen to my show, but when I went to the rainforest, which actually started my journey of Mrs. Green, one of the biggest challenges, and that some of the, you know, organizations like I'm thinking of the Pachamama Alliance and some other ones that we're working on, is the natives don't have deeds to their land. They don't think about it like that. They were born there. They live there. They can't produce a legal document, which is the way that the big corporations speak and say, this land was deeded to me. What they don't, it's like a foreign concept. We live of, on, and with the land. So it's, yeah, they can get bulldozed and not have literally a legal leg to stand on. So like Pachamama is working on getting deeded land to people that have lived there since, like you said, since the beginning of time.
Yeah, there's a lot of good work being done, and Forest Peoples Project is another great group. But, you know, if we overlook the human rights aspects of deforestation, we're sort of missing, you know, one of the most important aspects of it. And studies have shown that, in the tropics, some of the best managed forests are those managed by local and indigenous communities. Not surprisingly, you know, if the forest has been there for thousands of years with people living alongside it and depending on it, it's not a surprise that they're going to, they're going to be the best stewards of the forests going forward. I've seen that in many parts of the world. And that's why, another recent victory just last week, Forest Ethics, another great group that works on similar issues as Greenpeace, we collaborated with them, and the maker of Post-it Notes, 3M, came out with its first sustainable paper buying policy. So now you can feel better about those little yellow squares that you use to take notes and make your to-do lists.
Wow! That's huge. That's really huge.
Yeah. And that policy, which you can read on their website, includes what's called free, prior, and informed consent from local and indigenous people. So 3M is saying, you know, we're not going to buy wood fiber or paper for our products around the world if it's clear to us that local and indigenous peoples haven't already given their okay to proceed with something like a logging project on their traditional lands. So the marketplace, again, can be a really important driver, in a positive way, to ensure that indigenous people's rights are respected.
That is like beyond Thunderdome good news. I mean, and what to me, a lot of those companies, they're not the big bad wolves. They've been doing things a certain way. And what I see woven throughout this conversation is that Greenpeace and other great organizations are saying to these companies, we can still do this, but we can do it better without, you know, throwing aside human rights. It gives me a lot of hope, I can tell you that, because there are some dark days in Mrs. Green's world.
Yeah.
What do you say about, and you've kind of woven this in a little bit too, I'm very biased. I think that that anything to do with sustainability in terms of, you know, alternative energy, some of the things you're talking about, are they not job creators, really more sustainable jobs than, say, fracking, where you go in and it's my expression is slam, bam, frack you, ma'am, and we're out, and there's 9 people left to work? It's not job creation. So what you're talking about in many cases is sustainable, cleaner, greener jobs. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely. We know that we can't have a green and peaceful future if people don't have jobs.
Right.
And it's the same with our efforts to, you know, to create solutions to deforestation. It's not about setting up parks and kicking people out and telling them that, you know, this is off limits now and we're just going to look at it like a postcard. You know, there needs to be a sustainable way for people to improve themselves, their families, and have livelihoods into the future. So the whole argument of jobs versus the environment, I feel like is one that, you know, was really sort of from the 80s or the 90s, and everyone has moved on for it except for a few polemics out there who just want to kind of throw that out as an excuse for why business as usual needs to continue. It doesn't need to be business as usual. It should be business better into
right,
the future.
Right.
And I think developing countries are starting to understand that. I keep coming back to Indonesia, where I've done a lot of work, but I think the new president there understands that a sustainable development pathway doesn't mean no jobs for Indonesians. What it means is doing things a little bit better than had been done in the past. We don't need to repeat the mistakes of the past in order to develop. Technologies have changed. The world has changed. Economies have changed. The way we do business has changed. So we can have a more thoughtful approach to development. And I think a lot of times when people say that, you know, doing things right is just going to be too expensive, what they're focused on is the very short term. And unfortunately, that's not a good way to think. It's often the way that our human brains are sort of wired to think, I think, sort of.
Right, that, and getting, you know, more wired almost. It's like, hurry up.
Yeah, right. What's right in front of us, and we need to learn longer-term thinking. And, you know, changes can be painful. Like, if you want to lose weight, it's gonna take some sweat and you're going to be sore for a while.
Right.
But in the long term, you're going to be better off for it, and you're going to have a better life as well. That transitions have some of that sort of turmoil, and there's no discounting that. But I think that now's the time for us to start sort of taking a step back and planning for the future a bit better.
And one of the things that I see emerging more and more that is I so appreciate and I'm very hopeful about is that the conversations around the environment and environmental sustainability are definitely including a more just and sustainable future for everybody. It is talking about the slave labor conditions in the fashion industry and the packing industry, in the florist industry. More of those things, because of the amazing communicating technology, it's not just about not spraying the pesticide and the impact it can have on the earth. It's about the sprayer and what's happening to those people and their health and the cancer rate. So to me, it's becoming a much more integrated conversation. Has that been your experience?
Oh, very much so. You know, if we talk about, you know, the number one driver of deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon is the cattle industry. And so, you know, they're making way for basically grassland to feed cattle, but the industry itself has a larger impact than just on the rainforest. There is basically you know, neo-slavery involved in some of the working conditions in the industry. And so that's an important thing to take into consideration. We see that around the world where you know, those who exploit the earth are just as happy to exploit people. You know,
yes,
people are resources to them as well. And unless there's an incentive, especially a monetary incentive, to do something different, unfortunately, there always seems to be some humans out there who are willing to do that for, you know, to benefit themselves.
And in this, I mean, you're giving me some really great news. And I interviewed a woman yesterday from an organization called Kata. It's Consumers Against, I forget what the name of it was. It's all about the fashion industry and about sustainable apparel. And they're getting places. They're working towards organic clothing. She talked about all of the health risks for us that we're putting on our bodies because we're putting on things that are made from petroleum. But anyway, we have to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about what it's like to be an activist. And I'd like to talk about the Keystone Pipeline. And let's explore some of the myths about Greenpeace, which I think you've addressed already. Everybody stay here with me. Lots more good stuff. Ralph Skar, he is the director of Greenpeace USA's Forest Campaign. You won't want to miss a minute.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World, next.
Do you dare to share? In 2009, the University of Arizona started its car sharing program. Today, students, faculty, and staff have access to a shared fleet of cars that includes 7 hybrids and even the zero emissions Nissan Leaf. Not only does car sharing give the campus community wheels, but it takes all those extra cars off the road too. Now that greens things up, doesn't it? The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
We rely on your generosity for our inventory. Homeowners, renters, contractors, and business owners keep the Habit Store stocked with building supplies, furniture, and appliances. You can drop off your donations or give us a call at 889-7200 to schedule a free pickup of items that are in good condition. Your donations means Habitat Tucson can build and renovate more homes for hardworking people. The Habit Store's hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturday, 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road just east of I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I want to fix a little bit of a gaffe I made because I don't like it. I have so much going on and so many questions. But the guest that I interviewed is Patricia Davis, and her organization is Consumers Against Toxic Apparel, CATA. And it's all part of the same ongoing conversation. And a little shout out, remember that we have a great free mobile app that you can listen to our podcasts, download it from our website. Our shows can be listened to on our website and in iTunes. And please, as we said in the middle of the show, follow us on whatever your social media platform may be. Mrs. Green has them all covered. And while you're on our website, please take a look at our membership model and hopefully get excited about becoming a Mrs. Green World member, which helps support our free and independent radio. We like to think of ourselves as the PBS of internet radio, and we need member support. So please think about joining our growing number of people who support this really important mission where we can say anything and we say it responsibly. So our guest today is Ralph Skar. He is the director for the Greenpeace USA's Forest Campaign. And obviously, if you've been listening from the beginning, knows a lot about what's going on with forests around the world. So, Ralph, what's it like to be an activist? Tell us about the exciting life of being an activist.
Yeah, when I tell people, what do you do? And, I'm a professional tree hugger, and work on rainforest protection. It sounds kind of corny sometimes. And
sounds great to me.
People think that it means that I'm constantly, in the canopies of forests. But, day to day, like today, I'm just sitting in my office staring at a computer screen like many people
right.
who have office jobs here in San Francisco. But it is exciting to work with my colleagues around the world and to go to some of these places and both see the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that often informs and motivates me when I get back to my desk. I will say that it's not always easy. Over the years, I've received death threats. My colleagues who work in places like Indonesia face quite serious threats to their lives and their freedoms. Environmental activists around the world and those working on forest conservation are by no means better off than they have been in the past. There's the murder of activists. Something like two every week, unfortunately, in recent years around the world. And so, you know, moneyed and powerful interests, often with, you know, protection from corrupt governments and officials,
right?
You know, do threaten people's lives. And so it's not always easy, you know, pushing for change. But that's always been the case. You pick an issue that you care about and kind of rewind the tape and look throughout history, and you'll see that change makers are always prosecuted by those who benefit from the status quo.
And you know,
at the same time,
such a good point, though. No, that's really, let's give that a little bit of honor, you know, in focusing on it, because you're really standing on the front lines, your organization and many others, for the climate, for our planet. We all benefit because of the important and brave work you do. And I think it's great that you brought that up. I mean, it's not all fun and games. And I remember I was at a meeting for an organization here called Sustainable Tucson, and it was about somebody was going to be to demonstrate about the Keystone Pipeline. And this guy was like 70. And I said, so what's your goal? And he said, my goal is to get arrested. He said, I want people to know how much I care about this. And he was willing to go out there. He goes, I'm 70 years old. Who cares if I have a record? But that's right. The kind of courage you're seeing out there in some of these major areas that we need to be really concerned about. So go activist. So were you going to tell me about some of the fun parts?
Well, then there's a lot of fun stuff where you see, you know, companies really, companies and some governments really starting to get it and starting
right.
to engage on these issues and starting to, you know, everywhere I go in the world now, if I see a Kleenex box or a Post-it note or, you know, Head and Shoulders, which, you know, used to be, which was made by Procter & Gamble, and Procter & Gamble did not have a really robust policy for the palm oil.
To say the least.
Yeah, and now it does after a campaign that Greenpeace launched last year. You know, there's products on store shelves everywhere in the world that I know are now part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And so there's a yin and a yang to it.
And, you know, let's talk a little bit about, I want to talk about the Keystone Pipeline if we can, but when you're talking about the model, I'm so intrigued by the model. And I will tell you that some very nice young person, absolutely non-intrusive, approached me on the street in Santa Monica years ago. And I listened. And he told me how the money was going to be spent, how successful the grassroots community memberships are. What is the model that you use? Because you don't have enough staff to stay on top of all these issues. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, if you know, a lot of people in the U.S. have been approached by Greenpeace frontline activists. That's
right.
What we call them, folks with the clipboards. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. Sometimes when I'm walking down the street and I'm running late for something and my head is somewhere else and I see someone with a clipboard, I groan and think, oh, no, you know, how do I say no? Not those annoying people again.
And not be mean. But, I know.
But you know, they're actually essential to the work that we do. And it's some of the hardest work that we do is the folks who are out there with clipboards getting, you know, a lot of people saying no and a lot of hostile people and the rest of it. But the reason why they're important is twofold. First, you know, that when you signed up with that person in California, in Santa Monica, you were one of the people that helped Greenpeace remain independent. So it's
right.
It's people like you giving money, you know, $15 a month or more. You keep us independent from corporate and government money. And so it's only through that people power that we're able to be the independent voice for people on the planet that we need to be. And so that's absolutely critical. And if it means people are irritated a little bit on their way to Whole Foods, well, you know, so be it.
It takes a lot of guts to do that. That is not a fun job.
Other way to do it.
Right.
No,
right.
And it's actually something that most people can afford. And so, you know, if you can give $15 a month and you can, or if you just give a smile and a little respect to someone on the street with a very tough job, a very important job, then please do. The second thing is, you know, they're great for activating people. So let's say you can't give that day or you already did give. Those folks often have something you can do as well as giving. It's whether it's making a phone call to a CEO, telling them they should clean up their supply chain, or a call to the Obama administration saying, you know, you've got to reject the Keystone XL. Those folks, you know, will have a cell phone that's ready with a phone number, and will make it easy for you to, in 30 seconds or a minute of your time, to actually, you know, step up and take a stand for the environment.
It's just, I don't know. And I always say to people, you don't have to be mean. If you don't want to talk to them, just say, I'm too busy. And most people take that and they don't get in your face. And it's like, I admire the heck out of them. It's not a job I want to do. I can tell you that right now. I'd rather be sitting on my computer signing petitions than out, you know, getting in someone's face that might be mean to me. It's very admirable. What kind of role are you taking, if any, in the whole Keystone Pipeline conversation? And why does it matter so much to us in the U.S.?
Well, I think it's a flashpoint, you know, for the larger struggle to try to keep global warming under control. We already know that the planet's getting hotter, but scientists tell us that we need to keep it under 2 degrees average, you know, Celsius, in order for sort of the more catastrophic parts of climate change to kick in. And we simply can't burn the oil and the tar sands if we want to stay under that cap. And so, you know, the Keystone XL is a perfect sort of manifestation of what's wrong with the fossil fuel industry and our approach to energy. And it's a fight that is symbolic, you know, in many ways, in addition to being, you know, having a real world impact. It's sort of a fight for the future of our energy policy. And so Greenpeace, of course, is engaged on it. There's many other groups that are engaged on it as well. I know my Canadian colleagues not only, you know, are fighting over Keystone XL, but also going to the tar sands and blockading and trying to shine a light on the enormous environmental destruction that's already ongoing in places in northern Canada. And so we're bringing lots of forces to bear. We're supporting folks who are doing civil disobedience to block the pipeline,
right,
to make a political statement in D.C., and then also looking to divest. So, you know, where there are foreign investments in Canada fueling the ongoing development of the tar sands, we're putting pressure to bear to try to take some money out of it as well.
And the thing about the story, if you want to take a deeper look, there are lots of people in the heartland of our country and, you know, Native American tribal members. I've looked at a lot of videos. This is a really important issue that's going to impact all of us. And it should not be a divisive political issue, if you ask me. It's about our health and the health of our planet. And I don't understand sometimes how things just get flung in the political arena without really any contemplative thought. It just kind of mystifies me at times. Really, I'm sure you see that a lot too. What other ways besides the activists on the street, the frontline people asking for money, what other kind of campaigns do you do? Because you are huge. I mean, you are in many, many countries throughout the world and have offices and have key areas, all diverse, that you're looking at. How do you keep going?
Well, we have to set priorities, and there's too much work to be done for
right.
just one organization, but we have to have some strategic priorities. And so we work on, in the U.S., we work on oceans as well, so ocean
right.
conservation, in particular conservation of certain fish stocks. So tuna is a real concern for us right now, because many of the most famous tuna canned tuna brands have been doing things the wrong way and have been sort of driving populations of tuna towards, you know, commercial extinction. And so just in the last week, Greenpeace released a ranking of those canned tuna brands. So if you buy canned tuna, go ahead and log on to Greenpeace website and look at where your canned tuna stacks up. You might be pleasantly surprised, or you might be disappointed
and horrified and want to change your brand.
Yeah, like Bumblebee, for example, is not one that's doing things the right way, and they're using fishery techniques that basically guarantee that we're going to run out of tuna in the long run if we don't make some changes now. There are better ways of catching tuna. We're not saying don't eat tuna. We want a future for tuna.
Right.
We think it's a protein source for many people around the world. But if we keep it up right now, we're going to see a crash, much as we've seen crashes in other fisheries like cod over the years. So oceans are an important thing, toxics as well. We know that in America there are millions and millions of people who are at risk because of toxic facilities that, you know, can be doing business differently but are, you know, leaving Americans at risk just because this is the way they've always done it.
Right.
We want to see better regulations of many facilities so that large urban areas aren't at risk, whether it's an accident or a terrorist attack. We think that we should be smarter about the chemicals that we use so we don't have huge chemical disasters. It seems like every week you're seeing an explosion of some sort, whether it's, you know, oil being transported by rail or some sort of chemical facility. And you know, as tragic as those accidents and those incidents are, we know it can be a lot worse. And an ounce of prevention will be worth a lot more in the future if we only think a little bit more about how to phase out some of the worst and most hazardous of those risks now.
And when you work with organizations, so it begs a question, like you, the collaborative effort. I'm a big fan of the Monterey Bay Aquarium and Seafood Watch. Do you collaborate with big organizations like that? I mean, they have their little seafood guide that I've given out hundreds of at the events that I, you know, participate in.
Yeah, we do collaborate with the Monterey Bay Aquarium's guide, and we have a couple of guides that sort of complement there. So we have a guide, as I mentioned before, that you can get on greenpeace.org, a ranking of canned tuna, but we also have a ranking of retailers from Whole Foods to Walmart and Target and everyone in Trader Joe's and everyone in between. You can see when you go to the fish counter at one of those retailers, you know, do they have a bunch of red listed species, or are they phasing out some of the most endangered species and replacing them with something equally delicious but more sustainable? And so that's called we have an annual report called Carting Away the Oceans, and I think it's in its seventh or eighth version now this year. So you can check that out as well, and make it a little easier on consumers if you know that, you know, the retailer that you're going to has already done the work for you and has taken out some of the worst red listed species. You don't always need to cross reference it with your pocket guide when you're at the checkout counter.
And you know, what I want to say to people is, because we're going to be out of time in 3 minutes, it blows me away. But I want to tell people. And we, like I said, we have avid Mrs. Green World listeners. We're building our tribe. Go to greenpeace.org. If you care about the planet, there's something for everyone. It's a fabulous website. It's interactive. It's easy to navigate. You want to read more. When I talked to you yesterday, I said, I went down the Greenpeace rabbit hole because I wanted to read more about this, more about that. And it's not in any way, shape, or form negative. It's informative. It's content rich. It's hopeful. It's like, if people want to think and they want to talk about protected areas and why they're important, you know, why should we give wildlife a safe haven free from danger? Well, I care. I want to see the grizzly bears and the Arctic. We can do a whole nother show on the Arctic, but that's not your area of specialty. So we'll have to have somebody else back on that. So we have about 2 minutes, and I'm not going to get to ask all of my questions. But I wanted to ask you calls to action. That would be the most important thing to ask people that are inspired to help. What are some of the easy things they can do, large or small?
Yeah, that's right. And so there's some people who will feel inspired to take action and put their lives and their freedom on the line and do peaceful direct action or civil disobedience. But that's not the, you know, the entry to
right,
be an activist.
Right, it's not the masses.
Wait, volunteer.
Right.
We have a volunteer activist network around the country, so if you want to get the tools and the training and the resources to organize people in your community, no matter how big or small it is, and no matter where it is in the U.S., we have an activist network you can sign up for. We have something called GreenWire, which is sort of like a social network for activists.
Okay.
Share stories and resources. And then there's our regular email lists as well that lets you know how to plug in on, you know, national days of action and who to make a phone call to and what to click on in order to make sure that you're counted in the millions of people who are mobilizing now to protect our our planet.
And that's what's bringing change. That is what, to me, is bringing change, the activation of the matrix, and it's so easy, it takes seconds. We've got to go, everybody, and I'm sorry. I really wish we had more time. Thank you, Rolf, so much. I hope our paths cross again next week. Richard Louv, Children and Nature Network, talking about nature deficit disorder. You'll want to be here to hear that show as well. Everybody, make it a great green week, and thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World.